Thank you very much. I do have some handouts here. The last time I gave this presentation, I was soundly criticized for not having handouts. So I brought some here. Essentially, these are reproductions of what you will see up there, and they are for your reference. You just go ahead and take one and pass one on. And I also brought an award-winning flash short story, whose author is with us tonight, a friend of mine. His byline is Hamilton Waymire. This story won the Derringer for best 1,000-word story. So I brought it in so that you can see what a good flash looks like. And we'll get into explaining what all of that is to begin with. The thing I want to start with regard to short stories versus novels. It seems to be the great, or one of the great contests or points of contention among mystery writers. I've had novelists tell me that they could not do what I do, that is, write short stories. And therefore, a short story must be more difficult to write than a novel. On the other hand, I've heard other people say that it's easier to write a 5,000-word short story than a 100,000-word novel. And I certainly believe that's probably true. However, I don't know that it is easier to write 25,000-word short stories than one 100,000-word novel. So lots of times the question comes up is, are the skills different for writing a short story and for writing a novel? What makes them different? But there's some things I wanted to point out before we get actually into how a short story is different or how it's structured, what makes it a commercial property and all that sort of thing. And in that, the things I want to talk about specifically have to do with the development of short stories and also their place in mystery fiction. The word novel was originally applied to a work of fiction in the 14th century. Giovanni Boccaccio wrote a book called The Decameron, which has 10 people in a castle escaping the plague, and each one tells a story every night for 10 nights, so there are 100 stories in it. Each one of those stories is called a novel. And they're all quite short, in fact. So the first novels were actually short stories. Originally, the word novel meant novelty, as in an amusement. Later, novels got longer and longer and longer, and the short story kind of fell out of favor until around the 18th century, late 18th, early 19th century. But there's some things with regard to crime fiction I want to point out to you right away. First one is, the man who invented the mystery short story, the detective story, Edgar Allan Poe, we all know him, right? The first story he ever had published was Murders in the Rue Morgue, the story which established the detective convention. He then wrote two more stories featuring the same detective, the murder of Marguerite Roget and the purloined letter. Edgar Allan Poe, the man who invented the mystery, never finished a novel. Almost all of his writings were short stories. Who's the greatest detective in fiction? Sherlock Holmes. How many Sherlock Holmes novels are there? 4. How many short stories are there? 56. Sherlock Holmes is a character of the short story. The entire conventions and everything else in Sherlock Holmes being short stories. Dashiell Hammett. How many novels did he write? Answer is 5. How many short stories? The answer is 80. Raymond Chandler wrote 26 short stories and 7 novels. Even Agatha Christie wrote 150 short stories and 66 novels. I submit to you that the short story is the native form of the mystery or detective story. It really is. Now, these days, it has nowhere near the popularity it used to have. And a lot of this has to do with changes in society, the demands that we have on our time, and how we can sustain it. Ideally, a short story is bedtime reading. People don't always read before they go to bed at night anymore. They watch, you know, TV instead. But the whole thing about a short story is that you can read the whole story in the time between you go to bed and the time you turn out the light and not stay up all night. Likewise, short stories were very popular in magazines up until very recently. They were the favorite of people who rode the train to work. Cosmopolitan magazine used to be 90% fiction. Now they don't have any fiction at all. Reading habits have changed. But does that mean that the short story no longer fills a purpose? I don't think so. But I will tell you one purpose that it does not fill. You cannot make a living writing short stories. So anyway, let's talk about what's the difference between a short story and everything else. Whenever I talk to a group of writers, I'd like you to know that I'm not here to inspire you or to tell you what to write. One thing I know about writers is that no two work in the same way, and that everybody has their own attitudes, their own routines, their own things that they're trying to accomplish, and everything else. So usually when I discuss things for writers or aspiring writers, what I like to talk about is technique. That is the tools that you can use to accomplish your purpose, whatever that is. And you are free to accept or reject anything that I put in here. And with the handouts that I gave you, this is not a magic bullet or a gimmick. These are intended to make you think about what you write. And so it's not a surefire or strict method to actually writing fiction, but they're things that I think that you will be able to apply to your writing, whether you choose to write short stories or novels. The whole thing about writing a short story is, why do you write a short story? The short answer is because you love short stories. There's certainly, I can't think of another reason why you would spend the service in making a major production out of something that's only 5,000 words long, when you can spend your entire heart into a novel that's 80 to 100,000 words and have a real solid piece of work there. So you have to be in love with the genre. We'll talk a little bit about that. The first thing I want to point out is, I think there are 9 elements of plot in any kind of fiction writing at all. And these are fundamentals of short fiction. Opening, exposition, point of conflict, development, point of crisis, abatement, denouement, resolution, closing. You don't have to use all of these. Most stories do. Sometimes they can find them. But each one serves a specific function. The opening of a story is frequently considered to be the most important sentence in the work. I don't know if that's true, but it certainly is critical to getting a story moving. It is much more critical in a short story than it is in a novel. Because if you don't get the attention of the reader right then, they are not going to finish the story. Whereas a person who just spent 15 bucks on a novel is willing probably to give the entire first chapter a chance before they will determine whether they're going to finish or not. That's not the way a short story is. The other thing, too, is because a short story is essentially a very economic way of telling a story, every sentence and every word in it has to fulfill a narrative purpose. You cannot wing off and do philosophical musings or gratuitous character development in a short story. I'll talk a little bit later about character development in short stories and tell you a story where I was very scandalized with regard to the discussion between what people call plot-driven and character-driven fiction. But we'll get onto that later. So the opening is something that has to move the reader into the story. The worst thing that an opening can do, of course, is to be static and to give you information that does not demand that you read any further. The opening of a story always has to have something that compels the reader to read the next sentence. The last work that I have published is a hard-boiled detective story called Jungle Music in the, which is June 2010 issue of Ellery Queen. Here's the opening. The details didn't make the news at first. Too sensational for TV, too lurid for the Los Angeles Times. And anyway, who the hell cares about another nameless dead hooker? If you have that sentence and you don't have questions at the end of it, it's not an effective opening sentence. The reader has to have questions that he expects to be satisfied for the narrative to move on. After an effective opening, which, as I said, is to motivate the reader forward, exposition. Now, all stories have exposition. In a short story, the exposition is a little more strict than it is in other forms of fiction. The exposition serves only one purpose. That is to give the reader all of the information that is needed to understand what happens in the rest of the story. In a short story, the exposition does not give information that is not necessary for the reader to understand what is going to happen in the rest of the story. Now, I'm sure you all have heard the term backstory. You hear the word thrown around a lot. Most of the time it's used incorrectly. But I would like to make a distinction between backstory and background. Okay? Backstory is what you as a writer know about your character, about his past, about what motivates him, how he behaves, everything else. And gives you the idea of who he is. What backstory is not critical for is what happens in the story. That is background. It belongs to exposition. Anything that happens that has a bearing on the events of the story is not backstory. whatever you do, particularly in a short story, do not include backstory. Now, it's a novel, but I'll give you an example of what I'm talking about. The Maltese Falcon. When the Maltese Falcon opens, the only thing you know about Sam Spade is that he works at a detective agency, he has a partner, he has an attractive secretary, he's having an affair with his partner's wife, and he likes women. You never learn anything more about him during the entire story except who he is. You never learn how he became a private detective. You never learn how he got into an affair with his partner's wife. You never learn anything about where he was educated, where he was born, whether he's been involved with anybody, none of that. Because none of it is germane to the story. In a short story, that's exactly the sort of thing you should put in exposition, so that the events that then unfold are in context and people understand what they need. The next is point of conflict. Point of conflict in any story is where the action gets rolling. It's when the character, your central character, your protagonist, is forced to act. You may hear the old Joseph Campbell call to adventure story. Now, I have to be honest with you, I am not a big fan of Joseph Campbell. Although I think he's a brilliant man, and I was a brilliant man, and I think that he aided a lot in studying and understanding of mythology, I think it's a mistake to take what he has to say about folklore and legends and apply it to contemporary fiction, as so many people have done. However, in this particular instance, he had a strong point. And that is, a story is only engaging if the protagonist has a reason for doing what he's doing. Otherwise, it becomes an account. It becomes aimless. It's not going anywhere. In any story, the point where the protagonist must act is when he's introduced to some sort of conflict which must be resolved. The next part, after the point of conflict, is everything that leads up to the climax of the story. We call that development. Development is the most difficult part of any story to get right, because in order for it to work, what you have to do is ratchet up the tension gradually or quickly, depending upon what it is that you're writing. But the point is that tension needs to increase until finally it gets to a point where it can't sustain itself. Something has to give. And that's the point of crisis, which is the emotional conflict of your story. Climax of your story. I'll talk some a little bit later about the kinds of approaches you want to take with language when you're doing these sorts of things. Because the kind of language that you use is going to determine what the reaction of the audience is going to be, or the reader is going to be, to what you read. And, in fact, that becomes very important at this point. After that point of crisis, then what is a point of crisis? All right, let's say you're telling a war story, and your hero goes off to battle. And in the middle of the battle, everything hangs in the balance. Whether the good guys win or the bad guys win, you don't know. And he's there in the midst of it, and he gets hit upon the head with the butt of a rifle and passes out. And when he wakes up, the battle is over. That's your point of climax, your emotional climax, is when everything is on the line. But you don't necessarily know how the story ends at that point. But you hit the emotional high point. After the point of crisis, then you have abatement. Abatement is where you have to bring the reader down from an emotional high in order to sustain the narrative. Because the entire point of the climax is it is unsustainable. So in order for you to continue the story and finish the story, you have to damp things down a little bit. And that's why you would have your war hero in the hospital in bed and having the nurse and the doctor talk over him as if you were asleep or whatever, so that you are now tamping things down a little bit so that you can get on with the story. Following the abatement is what we call the technical climax or the denouement. The denouement, technical climax, is the part of the story where the reader knows how it is going to end. It is not the same thing as the ending itself, but it's when your lovers finally realize that they do love each other and want to spend the rest of their lives together. Now, you may have to spend a little extra time getting them together, but the point where that is revealed is your denouement, and means that the story now is winding down. The reader's going to recognize that and going to be satisfied that the resolution is finally coming to play. Following that, I have resolution. Resolution is simply tying up all the loose ends. Usually in any story, you've got several different things that are happening at the same time. And if you ignore some, the reader is going to notice that and not going to use a terrible word, achieve a sense of closure. They're going to want to know what happened to the minor characters. They're going to want to know how the battle turned out, even if it's not germane to the main action. They're going to know these things. You have to supply that to them in the close, in the resolution. And then finally you get to the end of the story or the close. The importance of the closing is it has to tie up everything very neatly so that, A, you return things to the status quo at the beginning of the story, which is typical in a series story, so that you don't have to read the adventures in order. You know, when you begin a Sherlock Holmes story, it's Watson and Holmes, 221B Baker Street, because in the previous story, they come back to 221B Baker Street. And so you either go back to the status quo, or you establish a new status quo, which is static enough that it will serve as the beginning of the next story if you're writing a series, or it will give the reader a sense of satisfaction that having read that story, that everything is neat and tidy and the end of the story. Sometimes, of course, depending on what you're writing, that closing may be challenging. I don't know if any of you have seen, Inception. Inception. Inception ends with a deliberately ambiguous ending. That's because that's the only way that movie can end. If it didn't have an ambiguous ending, I don't know if any of you have seen the story, I don't want to spoil it for you, but the whole story is about ambiguity. And if it didn't have an ambiguous ending, then the entire point of the story would have been lost. So in that case, that's a perfect closing. It's a resolution without resolution. So anyway, you can divide these nine elements essentially into two different types. I don't have it here, but the two different types are points and streams. Okay, here we are, points and streams. A point is an event that happens in the story that changes the direction of the action. Something that occurs in the story that makes it go in a different direction than what it was going in. So it's a discrete moment in time. Everything between points are streams getting from point A to point B. So points are opening, conflict, crisis, denouement, closing. Streams are exposition, development, abatement, and resolution. The typical plot structure I've drawn out for you here. I first learned this in 12th grade honors English longer ago than I will admit. But from my own practice as a writer, I have refined it somewhat from what Mrs. Mullen taught me back then. But essentially, you can see it kind of has like a hill sort of structure. You have an opening, the exposition is static, it gives you the information that you need, you have a point of conflict, tension ratchets up until you get to the point of crisis, tension ratchets down, the abatement, you reach the denouement at the end of the abatement, then you tie all the loose ends and have a killer ending. That's the central basic structure. Now, you have probably seen variations on this disguised variously. One of the ones that is most commonly used and is the most hideously disguised is Sitfield's three-act structure, which rules in Hollywood, which is very amusing because Sitfield has never written a good movie. But everybody believes that his three-act structure in describing how a movie should go is gospel. I don't like that, and I'll have a little bit more to say about that later. This is a much more versatile and much more specific structure than three-act structure is. Now, the next thing about short stories is, the reason we call them short stories is, oddly enough, because they are short. Essentially, there are three kinds of short stories. Now, I'm not basing this upon what people call them, or how people think they should be judged. The Short Fiction Mystery Society, for example, has, I think, five different categories for short stories. I think there are essentially three. And these are mostly have to do with what the market takes, that is, what you can sell, and what the editors are looking for. The first one of those is called a flash. A flash story is generally less than 1,000 words. It's one where the entire structure, that little roller coaster structure I showed you, is extremely compressed. I do have a diagram for a flash, which I'll show you a little bit later. But anyway, less than 1,000 words. Flash stories are not all that marketable most of the time, unless you're selling them to a semi-pro market or the internet. The reason for that is because serious editors, professional editors, are thinking in column inches. 1,000 words, 500 words to 1,000 words is an unusual column inch length. And it's difficult to fit it into a magazine. So usually the only time that they will take a flash is when it's brilliant or they need an extra page or two in order to fill out the number of pages that they have in the magazine. The next length is the traditional short story. I tell everybody to think in terms of 5,000 words, but anything between 3,500 and 7,500 is a short story. This is the one that you are going to have the most luck selling, because it's the one that the editor is planning on putting in the magazine or in the book. It's an anthology. To get the word count and the column inches they need in order to put their publication out. Finally, you have the novelette that is generally 8,000 to 20,000 words. The trouble with the novelette is if the novelette is 20,000 words, it's equivalent to 4,000 or 5,000 word short stories. So the editor, every time she buys a novelette, that means there are 4 short stories she's not buying. But that means that if you are trying to break into the market, the best length you go with is the traditional short story, right around 5,000 words. That's what's going to satisfy the editor's needs best. However, if you've written a killer story, it doesn't matter what the length is. I'll talk a little bit more about that, too. But these are the things I want you to think in. Also, I want you, as a short story writer, it is critical that you think in terms of word length and not page length and not any other criterion, but how many words you have. And how many words you have does not mean how many words are actually in your work. We'll talk about that a bit earlier, too. One of the things about that is the editor is going to expect you to give her a guess or an estimate of how long your story is. And she's going to use that to figure out whether she can put it into a particular issue or when she's going to put it in and how many column inches it will take up in her magazine. Here's the flash diagram that I promised you. Now, as you can see, it's a straight line. 2 points. What happens is in a flash is the points combine so that you have opening and conflict are the same thing. The story begins at the point where the protagonist is forced to act. So you have to have a catchy opening, and the action starts right away. So what happens is the exposition and development happen at the same time. As one of the things that we're using to crank up the tension is informing the reader of what the circumstances are. And each time you learn more about the circumstances, the tension increases. So exposition and development are combined. And then they finally end with crisis, denouement, and closing all at the same time. Now, Mike Mallory, who's another Southern California short story writer, likes to say that a flash story has exactly the same structure as a joke. You start the joke, 2 guys walk into a bar. Okay. You know immediately because of the conventions of a joke that there's something that's going to happen in the 2 guys walk in the bar, and then set up, punchline, and the story's over. That's exactly how a flash works. One of the things I handed out to you, as I mentioned, is a flash story that exactly illustrates the principles here that I'm talking about. And also it's the award winner, Edwin the Darren. Let's take a look now at 3-act structure. This is the classic 3-act structure that you will read in screenwriting books and in creative writing books and in all the sit field stuff. Essentially, it's got this line that is supposed to represent the whole narrative. And then they have an exciting incident, a midpoint, the climax. And then above that, you have what he calls 2 plot points to separate the acts, act 1, act 2, act 3. Ascending action, descending action. You can see that this is a lot more complicated than what I gave you. And a lot of it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. If plot point 2 is up here and you have a setting action, how can the confrontation, how can the midpoint be important? This is 3-act structure according to the diagram that I gave you. Alright? What happens here is opening, exposition, point of conflict, halfway through the development is where you interrupt act 1. Act 2 then goes further development until you get to something that is very typical in film, also in novels, much less frequent in short stories, and that is an intermediary crisis or crisis of confidence. In this particular plot design, what happens is your hero is brought low. Everything that he has attempted to do at this point is ruined. And it looks like he is no longer going to be able to solve it. He's completely defeated. But of course, being plucky, in Act 3, he picks up all the pieces, starts all over again. There's a new conflict, and finally we get to the climax, and the rest of it folds out the way it is. So you can see that this is this. But I think that's a lot easier to understand, don't you? Okay. The intermediary crisis, that crisis of confidence, is a very effective tool. It's a very effective part of storytelling. However, I warn you that it is also so conventional that it can be perceived as being trite or a cliche. So if you do it, you have to make sure that it's got a lot of punch and that it works. Because otherwise, if you do it, it's going to be predictable. And the last thing you want to do, although you want to satisfy the expectations that the reader has, the last thing you want to do is have the reader to know everything that's going to happen before it happens. This is a graph of a story I wrote. When I wrote the story, I did not graph. I only graphed it after I wrote the story. That's why I'm saying, when I'm showing you these graphs, I don't expect you to go home and plan your stories by drawing out a graph. The entire point of the graph was not to force you into a model. It was just to get you to think about the elements of the story that you're writing. But here's a case in point where, because of the way the story was told, it's a little odd. The structure's a little odd. In the story, it takes place in the 18th century. I write two primary series. One of them takes place in the 18th century, and my detective is an insurance investigator for Lloyd's of London. And the other one is the one I read from, for example, is contemporary hard-boiled. And then I write independent, you know, standalones all the time, too. In any case, the story starts off with a man running through the forest, and he's obviously in desperate straits. And then he hears hounds in the background, and then he is attacked by these dogs and killed. That's how the story opens. So you immediately have a conflict, immediately you have an oath. Then the body is discovered, but we have to ramp it down a little bit. He's been murdered, but the body is discovered, so there is no sense of immediacy because he's already dead. And then I go to a brand new opening. This is kind of like a teaser in Law and Order or any kind of television. Now what we need to find out is, how is this relevant to what's going to happen in the story? So the next scene, the new opening, begins at Lloyd's of London, where my detective is hired to investigate the murder. Okay. So then we have more exposition. We find out that the reason, or the problem with this man being murdered, and what makes it an unusual crime, and why they need to have an insurance investigator look into it, is because the murder took place in one of the national forests of Britain that supplies timber to the shipbuilding industry. And there has been widespread fraud in selling the timber to different shipbuilders that is threatening the Royal Navy and also the merchant bottoms of Great Britain. So the shipping industry has a vested interest in finding out who murdered this man so that they can get to the bottom of the fraud that's happening in the forests. After that, it follows pretty much the same sort of structure as most stories do. Except that the crisis and denouement, which is not rare, are actually combined in this case. That is, when you reach the emotional crisis, when he confronts the villain. The villain then shoots him, and his partner drops dead of a heart attack. So you know how the story is going to end, but the denouement occurs at the emotional crisis. So the abatement and resolution are combined, and then finally there's a closer where my detective is returning to London. So that's an example of how that story works. The one thing that's important to mark here is that there is only one point of crisis that is the ultimate crisis. There may be many crises along the way, but there's one overriding one that you're hanging your hat on in the story. The reader's looking for that. The reader wants to get a payoff for reading your story. And that payoff is always going to be at the point of crisis. All right. I mentioned talking about words and word length. And that brings us to the issue of counting words and making your estimation to give to the editor. Essentially, there are many different methods of doing this, but there are three main ones. The first one is trust your word processor. I'm here to tell you, don't ever trust your word processor with regard to word length. Because your word processor is going to consider the word of and the word anti-disestablishmentarianism as one word. What your editor is looking for when she's looking in terms of word lengths is the average length of the words in your story. So if your story is filled full of multisyllabic conglomerations of syllables or whatever, that's not going to count as one word. That may be three or four words. And likewise, if you are writing like Hemingway, 10 words is probably going to count as 5 words. What you're looking for is the average length. Now, there are two basic methods that are frequently used. The first one is the Courier 12-point method, and the second one is the three-page, three-line method. In Courier 12-point, what you have is you are in Courier 12-point. You don't use any other font than Courier 12-point. And you have 25 lines on every page. And then you count that as 250 words per page. So you multiply that by the number of pages that you have, adjusting for the beginning and the end. Because the beginning is only going to be half page, and you don't know how long that last page is going to be. And that will be your estimate. More accurate than that, though, is the three-page, three-line method. This is the one that they actually use in Dell Magazine, the gallery printed at Alpha Vision. What you do there is you go to the middle of your story, and you take 3 pages from it. You count the number of words that are in the top 3 lines of each of those 3 pages. And then you average them out, so how much is in a single line. And then you figure out how many lines there are per page, and you multiply, and that gives you your answer. Okay. It sounds a little complicated. It actually is not all that hard. I'm sorry? Okay, you take the middle of your story, you take 3 pages. You count the number of words on each of those 3 pages at the top 3 lines. Just the top 3 lines on each one of those 3 pages. You then use that as a basis to figure out how many words are on each line. And then you multiply that by the number of lines that you have in your story, which you can usually do by counting the number of lines on one page and the number of lines in the first and the last page. I'll talk a little bit more about widow and orphan control when we get there, because that's important in doing a manuscript, and most people don't know how to do that. We'll talk about it. Disable widow, orphan control. Okay, what are widows and orphans? Back in the old days, when people used typewriters, you just kept typing until you left the page. However, word processors, because computers are smarter than people are, will not let you put a lone word or a lone line at the top or at the bottom of the page where there's a break. What it will do is it will move it onto the other page, or it will move the page from the bottom of one onto the top of the other so that it looks creepy. So the number of lines that you have on any particular page may be different if you have widow and orphan control on. Editors don't want that. They want the number of lines on every page to be exactly the same. In order to accomplish that, you have to turn off widow and orphan control. I'm about to tell you. In Microsoft Word, it depends on the word processor. I tell you how to do it with Microsoft Word. If you use another word processor, just go to the help function and look up widow orphan. But in the format menu in Microsoft Word, there's a thing called paragraph. Okay? So you click on format, go down to paragraph, click on paragraph, and the window comes up. And at the top of those tabs, one of them will say widow orphan control. Click on that and then disable. So that's how you get rid of widows and orphans. It's there, trust me. Go to format, go to paragraph, look at the tab widow orphan control, click on that. All right. Selling stories. Crime fiction is commercial fiction. It may be artistic fiction, but it is aimed at a market. And in order for it to work in a market, you have to be able to sell it. Selling short stories is an art in itself. One of the main things you have to do is get to know your editor. And I don't mean simply personally, although trust me, that helps. What you need to know is what your editor is looking for the publication that editor is putting out. The only way really to know that is to read lots and lots of copies of the stories in those sources so that you will understand what the editor's tastes are. Now, everybody tells creative writers that you should not write to the market. If it's a fad, you should ignore that. That's absolutely true. And I agree with that. And I think that anybody who thinks that they are writing the next blockbuster because it's just like Dan Brown is really fooling themselves. But having said that, it is foolish to send something to an editor if you know that editor is going to hate it. you need to be able to understand what those editors' tastes are. So you may write something and realize that Ellery Queen is not going to print that story. But Linda Landrigan and Hitchcock might, because her tastes are different and the sorts of things that she's looking for in stories are different. So I say that you should match your submission to a specific market. I am not telling you that you have to tailor your submission to a specific market. But when you write something, you should know where the most likely chance of that story being accepted are going to be by knowing what the tastes and preferences of the author are. For example, if you write a woo-woo, you know, everybody knows what a woo-woo is, yes? If you write a woo-woo is a supernatural mystery. It usually has some kind of tarot reading or astrology or some kind of a vampire. Vampires are big. But it has some supernatural element that is blatantly fictive. I don't generally like woo-woos because I don't think they play fair with the reader as mystery stories. But if you send a woo-woo to Ellery Queen, I promise you, Janet will not buy it because she does not like supernatural stories. However, you can send that same story to Alfred Hitchcock and Linda will love it. That's what I'm talking about when I'm talking about tailoring or matching your submission to the market. It is also critical that you do not send the same story to more than one editor at a time. This is a little different than when you're looking for an agent or an editor at a publishing house where you want those guys to compete. What happens in the short story market, though, is if one person knows that you've sent the story to two different markets, both of them will reject it because they want to have exclusive consideration for that story at the time that they get it. If the story is then rejected by one editor, then you send it to the next editor, but never do it simultaneously. Okay? Guidelines. Generally speaking, any publication that publishes short stories will have writer's guidelines on their website. Read it. Is it gospel? No. The thing about writer's guidelines is they will tell you what the tastes are and what makes it easy for the editor to do her job. Doesn't mean that if you write a killer story and you use italics instead of underlines, that the story won't sell. Because I guarantee you, in any professional market, somebody is going to read your story. Now, in the magazine market, there's a thing called the slush pile. Have you all heard of that? Okay. The slush piles where unsolicited manuscripts by unpublished authors go. And there's usually an assistant editor whose job it is to go through the slush pile to look for the gems and to give the gem to the editor for consideration. Okay. In many ways, writer's guidelines are aimed more at slush piles than they are at the senior editor. Because if you have a relationship with that editor, if you're a published writer, it's going to go to her directly. And she's going to look at your story. But that poor assistant editor who is sloshing through 800 stories a month or more, it's going to be important that whatever you do, you make it easy for her to like your story. And that's the main reason for following writer's guidelines. Having said that, we'll talk a little bit more about how a short story should be formatted, how a short story manuscript should be formatted. Cover letter. Are cover letters necessary?
Depends.
I always have a cover letter, but that's because I have a personal relationship with my editors. And one of the things that my cover letter will say is, how are the husband and kids and cats and dogs? If I am writing an historical story that has a point of historical interest that's not included in the story, that might be a nice book to interest the editor in that story. This story is based on an actual incident that happened in 1784. In which so-and-so disappeared for 2 weeks and caused a flurry of betting in London. Okay? That actually is a story that I wrote. Except it wasn't 1784. But the point there is that the only reason for writing a cover letter is to provide information that is not in the story. The story is going to be read either way. If the story is strong, you do not need a cover letter. This is very different from publishing a novel or looking for an editor where the cover letter can make or break you. In the short story market, it don't make no never mind. So it's a question of judgment as to whether a story should be have a cover letter or not. I can tell you one instance where a cover letter can be very helpful. Generally speaking, if you have already commercially sold a story, it will not go to the slush pile. That is, if you sell a story to Andrew Gulley at the Strand, and then you send the story to Janet Hutchings at Ellery Queen, if she knows that Andrew bought one of your stories, she's going to take that story directly and not have it go through the slush pile. That's an instance where a cover letter can be very useful. My name is so-and-so. I've been published in the Strand. Because she's going to know from reading that. I mean, the assistant editor's going to know from reading that, that this is already a professional manuscript, and it's going to go directly to the editor. So that's the skinny on letters. All right. Let's talk some things about language, because I said that when we were at these different parts of the different stories, required different attitudes towards language. Fear. One of the most central elements of a story, especially a crime story, is sometime during the story, there has to be some expression of fear. We're writing about crime. We're writing about victimization. So somewhere in that story, somebody is afraid. Usually there are people who are afraid of different things in that story. The criminal is afraid of getting caught. The victim is afraid of being hurt again. Or if he's dead, his family is afraid. There are all of these different things. My point in bringing up fear is that there are different kinds of fear, and the way that you write about that fear is going to affect the way that it affects the audience. You know, if you write a romance, the romance won't work unless the reader knows what it's like to be in love. Right? What's the point of writing a romance story if you do not get emotionally involved with the characters? The same thing applies in crime fiction. You're going to have fear, you're going to have worry, you're going to have all of these things, and the best way to do that is to make the reader feel it. Because if the reader feels it, the reader is going to understand what the character is going through. However, there are different kinds of fear. There's the kind of fear that you have when you're on a roller coaster, and you are plummeting into the depths, and you are having sheer terror at this moment, where nothing is under control. Then there's the fear of walking through a foggy moonlit night with the coyotes or wolves howling. That's a sense of palpable fear. It's a dread. It's something that is oppressive and heavy. I submit to you that if you are writing about those two different kinds of fear, that the language you use to describe them should be different too. So that the language for writing about that moonlit foggy night should be heavy and oppressive and clawed. It should pound at the reader. But the roller coaster terror should be quick, fast, short, to the point, and rapid. Because that's exactly imitates the experience that your characters are going through and that your readers should go through. So likewise, if you are writing exposition and you are stating facts, you want to use a completely different tone of voice than when you are writing about your point of crisis. Getting back to my story here, here's some exposition. Let me see if I can find it here. Los Angeles is not only the mecca of the cult of celebrity, it's the mecca of Jerusalem, Rome, Galata, and Salt Lake City all wrapped up into one. My girlfriend Andy says it's a sign of the unwholesome American veneration of the entertainment industry that we apply such words as idol, icon, and diva more often to movie stars, TV personalities, and pop singers than we do to idols, icons, and goddesses. Organized religion is itself steeped in celebrity. The Church of Scientology, notorious for its recruitment of film actors, is headquartered in an old hospital building that looms over Hollywood like a haunted hotel in an old Universal monster movie. Amy Semple I built her Church of the Four Square Gospel right here in L.A., the first religious organization to operate a radio station, and so became the godmother of today's slick Bible Belt evangelists. More traditional religions are hardly immune either. Our new multi-million-dollar Roman Catholic cathedral, looking like a hip college campus cross-pollinated with a hip movie studio office building, is cynically referred to as either the Roger Mahal or the Taj Mahoney after the camera-ready cardinal who built it. The glass and steel non-denominational crystal cathedral, an institution firmly based on mainstream American Protestantism, which, like Disneyland, is located in urban Orange County rather than L.A. proper. Everybody knows the O.C. is really nothing more than the South L.A. burbs. Try as extensions might to deny it. Anyway, the Crystal Cathedral actually advertises all the stars who show up to participate in its nationally televised services. But the real old-time religion, the one true creed in sunny SoCal, is not, as you might expect, fame. It is certainly not God. It is greed. That's exposition.
Did you write
Oh, yeah. Okay, now, further on in the story, I'm going to move now to an action scene. And you can see how the language is completely different. Okay. One of my detectives has gone to Orange County, has gone to Newport Beach, to break into the house of a celebrity, another celebrity PI who has been murdered. Any resemblance with Anthony Pelicanos is entirely deliberate with regard to that murdered PI. But he believes that there is a recording that will cast a light, or at least explain what these events have been going on. So he finds the guy's house. Remember, the guy's been murdered, so the house is unoccupied. Okay. I headed to his home address in Orange County first. I figured law enforcement had already done a pretty thorough job in his office looking for evidence, so my hunch was that whatever I was looking for would be in his car. Traffic on the 405s had crawled at the best of times, and it was late afternoon by the time I got there. I was only going to look around a little. I don't usually go armed. There's no reason to unless you're expecting trouble, so I'd left the Beretta at the office. Turns out that was a mistake. The garage was a attached building dating from the 20s with room for three limos big enough to two of Norma Desmond around it, and even had chauffeur's quarters above the coach house. I looked on the key ring for the electronic remote that would open the doors, not imagining for a moment that Carlucci would ever condescend to manually swing them open. But there wasn't anything there that worked. I thought that maybe the little fob might be it, but there wasn't any kind of button on it at all. So I let myself in through the side door intended for people, taking just long enough to figure out which key fit in the doorknob. I walked in, leaving the door open behind me because it was dark inside and I didn't see a light switch on the wall. There was only one car and a home weightlifting gym featuring both free weights and a couple of expensive machines. A shadow moved across the floor, cast from the open door behind me. I turned and looked. At first I thought he was probably a cop. He was dressed in black parachute pants and a black tee that stretched across pecs the size of hubcaps. There was a pistol, and I found out later it was a Heckler & Koch USP Tactical 45, a gun designed for special forces, strapped to his thigh in a nylon holster. He was just removing silvered aviation shades from his eyes. I didn't like his face. His black hair was cropped short, high and tight, not like a cholo skinhead shape. It was a military cut. "Hey, you got something for me?" he asked, coldly smiling. His voice was high and hoarse, and he spoke with a Spanish accent. "Who are you?" "El Muerto." And then he landed a stiff one right in my solar plexus. I dropped hard on my face, and the keys flew out of my hand, jingling as they hit the concrete floor. I couldn't breathe. I heard him kick the door shut, and then he flicked the lights on. My eyes felt like they were being bleached, whether from having the wind knocked out of me or because of the sudden brightness, I can't say. But I remember thinking, he's been waiting here long enough to know where the lights are. "You should work out, pendejo. Pump iron, you know." I heard the slither of metal against metal as he pulled something from the rack of weights behind him. I tried reaching for the keys. They were too far away. My fingers clenched around nothing but dust. He shoved a toe under my stomach and flipped me over like a flapjack. He stood above me, holding the 45-pound round plate in his hands, 3 feet over my head. He smirked and said, "Adios, cabrón." He raised the plate another 6 inches and aimed it at my head. I tensed against the fatal impact, and my right hand landed right on top of Tommy's keys. When the assassin had turned me over, he'd accidentally pushed me closer to where they had fallen. I wasn't thinking at all when my fingers crunched around them. I was just waiting for death. The Cayenne chirped and revved up. I'd unintentionally activated the keyless ignition. It distracted him for a split second, just time enough for me to roll, catching his ankles with my legs, sending him crashing to the concrete next to me. On the way down, he smacked his head on the way. It bounced twice with gong-like clangs, then lazily rolled away before splitting flat. By that time, we were both struggling to get on our feet. It was lucky for me they clipped so hard on the way down, it evened the odds. His eyes were glazed, and a trickle of blood dripped from his left temple, but he had enough presence of mind, or maybe instinct, to go for his pistol. He would have been smarter to get in the next punch. We both went down with my haymaker, but he also went out.
Great.
So, this is what I'm talking about. The language you're going to use in the story is going to depend on where it's being used and the impression that you want to leave. Okay? That's something you should be aware of, and that's why it's good to know what these points are. Rather than, I'm not telling you need to graph out your stories. Every writer has their own ways of doing things. But you should be aware of what function the storytelling, the narrative is that is being used when you are in any particular part of the story. The last thing I want to talk about is the word that you most frequently hear when somebody's talking about short story. And that word is economy. Okay? People say that the thing about short stories is they have more economy than novels do. I don't know if that's true or not. I'm a short story writer. For me, writing a novel is difficult. For a lot of novelists, writing a short story is difficult. I don't know what the difference is. It's a question of what you feel comfortable writing, I suppose. But I do know something about economy. And what I know about economy is not the shortest way to say something. It's the most effective way to say something. Think about it like this. You buy the bargain brand and you use four times as much of it when you buy the concentrate at twice the price. The concentrate is more economical than the bargain brand because you're getting more bang for your buck. And that is particularly true in writing short stories, is that you want the language not to be digestible, so richly digestible, but you want it to contain enough extra in it that it pushes things forward or gives you more information. Another one of these stories with those detectives, I describe a guy going to a house in Pacific Palisades. And what he says is, because the streets switch back, that it's as tangled as a can of worms when he's driving up there. Now, that's a couple of rhetorical devices using there. First is the metaphor, the streets are like a can of worms. There's also another rhetorical device there called synecdoche, where you refer to something in terms of something more general. You can't actually tangle a can. You tangle the can of worms, or the can of bait, you're talking about the worms inside. But the point is, by using that image describing the streets, I'm also describing the story, because there's a tangle of facts that need to be unwound. And that's the kind of thing that I'm referring to when I'm talking about economic writing, is putting in that extra bit that helps identify the story and helps the reader take it all on board and know what it is that they're reading or get them in the mood or whatever. Finally, character. And plot-driven, character-driven. Those words are so completely misunderstood by most people, no matter what kind of fiction you're talking about. Usually when people say something is character-driven, they mean that the actual characterization is more important to the story than the events that happen in it. Likewise, when people say something is plot-driven, that means that there is no characterization and only action. I'm here to tell you those ideas are wrong. The difference between being plot-driven and character-driven is the motivation. A character-driven piece is one where the action is driven by the decisions of the characters. A plot-driven piece is where the characters are reacting to a set of circumstances they have no control over. So, for example, take Gift of the Magi, the famous O. Henry story. Very, very short. Okay? Completely character-driven. Everything in that story has to do with the decisions the characters make. Take another story, say, War and Peace. War and Peace, in many ways, is completely plot-driven because it's Napoleon invading Russia. You can't change that. So everything that those characters do has to do with Napoleon invading Russia. It's plot-driven. Are the characters less sophisticated in War and Peace than they are elsewhere? No. There's only such thing as good characterization, bad characterization. In a short story, the characterization has to be germane to the story. Doesn't mean that you can have less characterization, particularly if it's a series character and you're writing it over a long period of time. The point is that the part of the character that you're displaying to the reader is germane to the story. If the story is different, the parts of the character that you're going to develop are also going to be different. And over a long period of time, your character is going to be just as well-rounded as any character in any novel. I told you that I was at that party, and I met a young woman. That was Mystery Writers of America party. And it was shortly after Les Klinger had relieved me as president. And I met a very attractive young woman. And she was talking with Thomas B. Sawyer, who many of you might know, big writing teacher and former showrunner for Mystery She Wrote. And she met me and said, "Oh, are you a writer?" And I said, "Yes." I mean, we were at an MWA party. Everybody there was a writer, right? I said, "Yes." She said, "Oh, what do you write?" I said, "I'm a short story writer." She said, "Oh, I much prefer novels because I'm interested in character-driven fiction." And, of course, I nearly blew my top because she didn't understand what that meant. It was something that she had heard probably at a cocktail party and decided that anything that has good characters and is character-driven, anything that doesn't have good characters is plot-driven. That's not what it means. These are techniques. any technique that you use, including the ones that I was talking about, Gary Lange and everything else, is absolutely worthless unless it helps you to tell the story. That's what rules everything. It's all about the reader and what tells the story to the reader. So you can show off your massive vocabulary and your wit, and if it doesn't move the story forward, you're wasting your time. On the other hand, if you do not use any techniques at all, the story's going to be flat. It's not going to be alive. It's not going to engage the reader. They have to be able to have the words mean something to them. It doesn't mean the words should call attention to themselves, because the last thing any writer should do is call attention to how brilliant you are. You don't want your reader thinking about you. You want your reader thinking about the story. And that's what makes the story work. And that's especially true, I think more true for short fiction than it is for anything else. That's what I got. You guys got any questions? Yes? No. The reason is that the denouement won't come before the point of crisis. Well, no, I take that back. There are stories where the denouement is obvious from the beginning. Like, for example, the character is doomed. You know that nothing is going to prevent that character from being doomed. And you know that throughout the entire story. Phil Noir is a classic example of that. You know, the poor Julep who gets involved with the gangster's girlfriend, you know right from the beginning that this guy is doomed. And there is nothing that's going to make that not happen. You don't know exactly when that's going to come across. And part of the fun of a noir story is he almost gets away. And then he always gets pulled back. So in that sense, yes. But generally speaking, the reason why you have to have the denouement after the climax or at the climax is because if the reader knows how the story is going to end, there's no payoff at the climax. He already knows what's going to happen. Why slog through the rest of the stories to get to a climax?
Identifying the suspect isn't your general mom. Catching the suspect.
And that's not at all unreasonable, particularly in hard-boiled. You know, one of the big differences between a fair play story and a hard-boiled story is a fair play story, the clues are all hidden. You know, generally they are disguised along the way. It's a casual remark or a casual observation. Whereas in a private eye story, you follow the private eye as he burns shoe leather going from place to place, and you learn everything as he learns it, and so you arrive at the conclusion at the same time. So the whole thing is both of those stories have climaxes and denouements, but the way they get there is different. Other questions?
Sure. Anything to get their attention, I told Hamilton, Kai, back there, the next time he sends a letter to Hitchcock, he needs to mention that Derringer.
Because that's going to make a big difference for the way she's going to look at that story. Other questions? Yes, ma'am.
I just read them, but I'm curious, like something like Elvie, when you that particular, you come out once a month, and you buy it at a newsagent, you can get it at Barnes & Noble.
God bless you. Ellery Queen and Alfred Hitchcock are both published by Dell Magazines, which is a branch of Penny Publications. They come out 11 times a year, mostly monthly, but every year they have a double issue that covers 2 months. Okay, I'm glad you mentioned that because I needed to talk about markets. I forgot to talk about specific markets. Essentially, in short stories, there are three kinds of markets: magazines, anthologies, and semi-pro, which is usually means the web, although it could also mean a fancy. Magazines, they're really, unless you are Ray Bradbury, you know, or John Updike, magazines means Ellery Queen, Alfred Hitchcock, and The Strand. Women's World will publish a very specific kind of mystery. They pay very well, Women's World does, but it has to be very short, like 500 words, and it has to be a puzzle story with the solution separate at the ending for Women's World, but they pay very well. The other than that, anthologies. How do you get into an anthology? Well, there are two ways. You guys are in Sisters in Crime. Sisters in Crime is famous for doing short story anthologies. And most chapters will do their own independent ones. I greatly encourage you to participate in those because people read those books. Sisters in Crime anthologies are very highly regarded, maybe not among the general public, if you have to be a bestseller, but other mystery people are going to read them. And if you are interested in doing something, if you really want a novel and you wrote a short story, that short story anthology is going to be submitted for Edgar consideration, I guarantee it, at the end of the year. And if you win the Edgar, it's going to be a lot easier to sell your novel. So I recommend that you do that. You participate in any organization that publishes anthologies submitted. MWA does an annual one. Most of the stories in there are pre-selected, but they open it up to blind submissions for about 10 spots. If you're not a member of Mystery Writers of America, I recommend that you join and participate in that. Other than that, the only way to get published in an anthology is to know the editor. So one of the things that you really need to do as a short story writer, just like you do as a novelist, is network and network and network and network so that you know if somebody gets assigned or has an anthology, you're able to say, hey, I heard that you're doing this anthology. What's it about? And figure out if you can sell a story to that anthology that way. Then the other market is what I call a semi-pro market. They usually pay $10 for whatever length of story you write and a copy of the magazine if it's in print. The semi-pro is not something I write for. I think that what I write is worth more than $10. So when I write something, I will send it to a professional market. That doesn't mean that it doesn't have its place, though, and that it's not an important outlet for people who want to be exposed. Kai's story, Hamilton's story, was published in online for a semi-pro market. He got $10 from it, but he also got a Derringer out of it. You know, so that was well worth the $10, in my view. The disadvantage, lots of times, of a semi-pro market is that unless you win a Derringer, a professional market is going to consider you probably is not playing with the big boys because you were willing to go down a step. Not always. Mike Mallory, who I mentioned earlier, sells to Futures Mystery Magazine Anthology pretty frequently, which is essentially a semi-pro fanzine of mystery stories. The standards in Futures are generally pretty low, but Mike is such a good writer that it doesn't hurt him at all. Stuart Kubitsky used to sell to them too. I think mainly because he liked the editors, because of course Stuart Kaminsky was Stuart Kaminsky. But those are essentially those three markets: magazines, anthologies, and semi-pro markets. Any other questions? Well, thank you for your attention. I appreciate it very much. I hope you were able to bring something to you.